Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Ellen Kozak, a lawyer specializing in copyright, media, publishing, and entertainment law, as well as the author of several books, including Every Writer's Guide to Copyright and Publishing Law. Welcome, Ellen.
Hi, Rochelle. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Well, one of the questions I hear most from writers, especially new writers, is this. How do I copyright my work? Can you tell us a little bit about what copyright means and how to get it?
Well, copyright is the name we give for the bundle of all the rights that an author has in an original work of authorship. And as long as your work is original, it's created by you out of whole cloth, and it doesn't have to be novel, it just has to be original, then you own the copyright from the moment that the work is fixed in any tangible medium of expression. And that means not only can you do it by writing it, but you can do it by dictating it into a tape, and you can do it by typing it into a computer. Any medium of expression from which it can be read back, once it's fixed, the copyright exists.
So what does it mean then to register a copyright? How is that different?
Well, normally you register the copyright in a work after it's published. You can register it before it's published, but it's really not necessary, except perhaps when you're dealing with screenwriting, because things that happen there, it's such a collaborative effort that things sort of disappear there. But as far as writing for print, you usually don't have to get it registered in advance. You just register once it's been published.
Okay.
And if you sell your book, then the publisher will register it. But you register it with the Copyright Office in Washington, D.C., which is a branch of the Library of Congress. And they have a new formula now for registering online, and I haven't tried it yet, so I can't tell you exactly how it works. It's a little bit cheaper than the $45 that you normally pay to register when you send it by snail mail. And essentially, you send in the appropriate form and two copies of the published work or one copy of the unpublished work and the appropriate fee, and they register the work for you. And at that point, you have certain extra rights. If you want to sue in court, you need to be registered before you can go forward. But since you very seldom really do need to sue in copyright, it's usually not recommended that you would register before you're published.
Okay. Well, that helps. So you have a chapter in your book, Every Writer's Guide to Copyright and Publishing Law, about names. Can you give us some tips about libel and privacy? And, you know, I'm thinking about people who are writing memoirs. You know, how do they get around this, and how do they write about their own life without getting sued?
Well, it's a very complicated issue. First of all, let's distinguish between fiction and nonfiction.
Okay.
If you're writing fiction, it has to be fiction. You can't just take your neighbor's life and change the names and write about everything that happened to your neighbor. That's not fiction.
Okay.
That's biography with the names being changed, and you may be invading that person's privacy if that person is recognizable, especially if you put words in that person's mouth and you envision a scene that never happened. You may be creating a situation that is defamatory. That having said that, I mean, fiction should be created out of whole cloth. I mean, we all base our fiction on our personal experiences, but then you extrapolate from there and just go off into a completely different type of thing. You can't very well reproduce the scene that really happened. Then it's not fiction. But if you're writing nonfiction, such as a memoir, or if you're writing nonfiction, if you're writing articles, I do a lot of writing of articles, then what you want to do is make sure, because truth is a complete defense to libel, so you have to make sure that there is truth in what you are writing. You can't fabricate it. You cannot embroider on it. If you find out that somebody had a meeting with someone else, you can't put a third person there, just because you think it might be interesting. You can't make up a scene. If they tell you three people were there, that's fine, but you can't put words in their mouths. That's not permissible. When you write nonfiction, you have to really write appropriately. Now, having said that, there are certain people who have sacrificed their right to publicity by becoming public figures, and there is a lot more leeway to write about public figures such as actors and actresses and public officials such as the President of the United States, which still doesn't mean that you can put fictitious words in their mouths, but on the other hand, it is possible to, for example, have a scene at which somebody appears at a, let's say, a science fiction convention and runs into a science fiction movie star. at that convention. Well, if it's likely that they would be at such a convention, and they're not doing anything untoward in there, they say, oh, we're going to get an autograph from William Shatner, who would play Captain Kirk, or something like that, then you're okay to put something like that in there. When you put words in his mouth or have him doing something, then you're approaching the defamation, and you have to be a little bit careful.
Wow. So now one of the things I've heard about memoir writing is that if it happened to you and it's your version of truth, it's okay, even though the other people in the situation might see it differently. Tell me what you think about that and what the law thinks about that.
Well, it's really hard to generalize, first of all, because that kind of thing is different from one state to another.
Uh-huh.
Whereas copyright law is the same throughout the United States. Defamation and invasion of privacy can differ from different states. For example, in California, dead celebrities have a right of publicity. In Wisconsin, dead people do not have a right of publicity and privacy.
Wow.
So I think it depends on what state you are writing in and what state you're writing for. The statement that truth is a complete defense to defamation has always been the basics, but there are times when, depending on how you construe the truth, you really have to be very, very careful in your wording. And again, if it's the way you remember it happening, if you just state facts, it's one thing. If you start putting descriptive implications in, you could have a problem.
Wow. So what's your advice to autobiographical memoir writer, for checking things out and trying to figure out how to publish their work in a way that's going to respect the privacy and rights of other people?
Well, one way is to be on good terms with those people.
Yeah.
And just, have them read it over and say, this is what I'm putting in there. Do you have any problems with that? And if they don't have any problems, then, you shouldn't have that, especially if you send it to them by an email so you have some kind of a record.
Okay.
That you said, did you have any problem? They emailed you back and they said, oh, no, it's great. I'm looking forward to the book. Then you know that at least they saw it, they consented to it. Shouldn't be a problem. But were you on bad terms with these people, it sort of depends. Now, they have to find a lawyer who's willing to take the case. Cases just don't happen.
Yeah.
And, lawyers will think this over very carefully, because one of the problems when you bring a suit in defamation is that you just aggravate the circumstance. In other words, if four people saw the book and recognized you in the book and called you up and said, well, we saw you, we're sure that this Mary Jones in the book is really you. You're a little bit upset about that, that's fine, but that's only those four people who saw it, unless you can extrapolate from that and realize that the whole world knows about it. But on the other hand, if you bring a lawsuit, then that just brings it up to the fore again, because then there's publicity about the fact that a lawsuit was brought by this person against this author for having written about them, and that gives it even more publicity, and people never remember what the truth was. They just remember that something happened.
Wow.
So you really don't want to aggravate that, and most lawyers will advise people to forget about bringing that kind of a lawsuit, as long as what you've done is fairly minor.
Yeah.
If, on the other hand, you're doing something really terrible, really terrible implications, if you're implying, for example, that somebody's mother was a hooker, then I would say that, yes, you might have a problem.
That's fascinating. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit more about names, because you talk in your book about using an alias or a pseudonym. Tell me what writers need to know about this and why a writer might choose to use a pseudonym.
Well, again, it depends on what state you're in. Some states, such as California, have a fictitious name statute where if you're going to use another name, you have to register it with the state.
Wow.
But most states don't have that kind of a statute, which means that any time you take another name and it's not for fraudulent purposes, but just to protect yourself, there is no problem with it. I wrote my science fiction novels under a pseudonym, and I did it because they're a little bit racy, and I was practicing a lot of trial work at the time, and you just don't want to have this kind of thing come out in the middle of a trial.
Yeah.
I think it could prejudice your case. So I wrote them under a pseudonym. And the other reason for writing under a pseudonym may very well be that if you're writing several different kinds of books, let's say you're writing mysteries, but you're also writing cookbooks.
Yeah.
And you're writing children's books as well as racy adult books. You don't really want to put the same name on both sets of books, because somebody who has been reading your children's books might go out and pick up one of the racy adult books and think it's good for their kids.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't want to do that necessarily. This is one way of just keeping your audiences separately. And there's this classic story that Queen Victoria liked Alice in Wonderland so much by Lewis Carroll that she asked for the author's next book, and he wrote that under his real name, Charles Dodson, and it was a mathematical treatise.
Oh, no.
She wasn't exactly entertained by that.
Oh, that's great. So I can see that there's reasons to do it. Now, I have noticed that some authors are pretty open about their pseudonyms, and others don't reveal it at all. Do you know anything about that? Or?
Well, it's a matter of personal choice. In other words, if you don't really care if people know that these are your books, that's one thing. I think some people have written books under pseudonyms because of the way that their career was going, and then afterwards, when the career is much better, they don't mind revealing it. On the other hand, if you're really a prodigious writer, you're turning out books like crazy.
Yeah.
It may very well be that the public is going to get saturated by it, or people are going to think you're not really writing all your own books. So that might be a reason for not, giving the word out, or it might just very well be that you want your privacy.
Wow.
And if you want your privacy, you don't want everybody on the street to know that you are actually the person who wrote all these best-selling books, because then they'll all be at your doorstep all the time.
Well, now that would be a great problem for some of us. So I know you want to educate writers about possible publishing scams. Can you give our listeners an idea of what to watch out for?
Well, I think what you have to realize is, first of all, it's very, very few people get rich writing.
Yeah.
You hear about the fact that people get $1 million advance for their book or a $10 million advance for their book. Yes, ex-presidents of the United States get that. Movie stars get that. The rest of us don't get that.
Yeah.
And so unless the book really takes off, your first book takes off so well that it makes $1 million, then the second book you might get a big advance for. Most of the time, you're not going to get a big advance. On the other hand, if you are paying to get published, it's the wrong thing. That's a vanity press, and
okay.
Publishers do not ask you for money. They ask you for your sweat equity. You put in your labor, you turn out this book, and after you turn in the book, they ask a bunch of questions. They edit it. You have to go over it and read the galleys. You have to go over and read what the proofreader did. You have to read what the copy editor did. Then you have to read it when it's in page proofs. If it's a nonfiction book, you may have to do the index yourself or have someone else do the index. I've always done my own indexes because it gives me one last look at the book. But in all these things, you're putting in a lot of effort, and you shouldn't be asked to put forth money also. The publisher should be the one who is gambling on you and putting forth the cost of the book. So if somebody is asking you for money, it's probably a scam. You don't pay. The rule of thumb is they pay you. You don't pay them if you're a writer.
So what about the writer who wants to self-publish? How do they kind of distinguish between a legitimate self-publishing company and a scam?
Well, frankly, I don't believe in self-publishing.
Okay.
I think that there are very limited times when you should self-publish. One time is if your book has a very, very limited possibility of selling. For example, if it's just a memoir that you only want to be distributed at your family reunion to your grandchildren or something like that, and you only think that you only want to sell about 50 copies of this book, then go ahead and self-publish. But then go, get an editor to help you with it. Don't even bother, because it's not going to be for sale in bookstores with things like an ISBN number,
okay,
or a barcode, because you're not going to need it. You're not going to be selling it anywhere. And have it printed up at some place that does offset printing, like FedEx, Kinko's, or someplace like that. Have it bound and give it out to your family, and just assume that that's what you did for a treat for your kids.
Yeah.
If you want to sell your book, then you have to figure out whether it's going to have a legitimate audience. If you're writing a book about the best restaurants in a very small town that has 4 restaurants in it, you can guess that all 4 restaurants are going to carry this book about the 4 restaurants.
Yeah.
And you could probably pre-sell it to them, and maybe the drugstore will carry it. But again, 50 copies is like the maximum that you'll be able to sell, unless you sell them to everybody in your family. So again, self-publishing that, you don't want to do a big print run. You want to do what you can sell. And now with print-on-demand, you're able to do that in a very limited way. If you think you are going to self-publish and distribute your book, what you've done is just bought yourself very expensive attic insulation.
Really?
Yeah, unless you have a distributor and they can sell it, unless you are out there pounding the pavements, unless you're in the PR field and you know how to get a lot of publicity for your book, chances are 9 out of 10, the book is just going to die on the vine. The only bookstore that's going to carry it is the one that you buy all your books from, because they figure that they owe you, and then they'll buy it from you on consignment or outright, but, you know, they're going to want to do 100% markup. So if the book is marked $10, they're going to buy it from you for $5.
So in a sense, the only people who really are going to benefit by self-publishing are the people who have that kind of natural venue to sell their books.
Right. If, for example, you're a public speaker and you're on the road, I can see where you would, you know, publish the handbook and either give it out as part of it, you know, part of the registration. If you register for this seminar for $25, you will get the handbook. Or the alternative is, you know, I'm giving the seminar for free, but, you know, my associate is in the back, and she'll take your $25 for the book.
Yeah.
And then you have, if you have that kind of thing. But again, I saw one vanity press, one of the places that, you know, you pay to get published, that actually had a system set up where they said, well, if you buy 3,000 of these books, you can sell them and you can make a whole lot of money. You can go to 10 cities and you can have 4 engagements in each city, and you can sell 75 books at each engagement for, you know, 2 lunches and 2 dinners.
Wow.
And, you know, the rule of thumb actually is probably if maybe 1 in 10 people at a seminar or at a speech will buy the book.
Yep.
And if only 1 in 10 people are going to buy the book, the only way you're going to sell 75 books is if 750 people come. And in a strange city, why would 750 people come to your speech?
Right.
So unless you are notorious or famous for something else, if you've just, you know, saved someone's life, if you've gotten a lot of press on television, it's very unlikely that people are going to come to these speeches. If you're Norman Schwarzkopf or if you're Bill Clinton, they might come and they might buy your book. But otherwise, you just aren't going to be able to sell 300 books in 10 cities.
Yep.
You're going to be lucky if you can sell 30 books in one city.
Well, I think that's a very great dose of reality, because those of us or those writers who are dreaming of fame and bestsellerdom need to have those kinds of doses of reality.
Well, the thing is that most authors now are getting royalties, or rather getting advances from the legitimate publishing houses, of probably between $3,000 and $10,000.
Yeah.
Now that is what the publisher is guessing you will earn in royalties on your book at 10% to 15% for a hardcover, and perhaps 6% to 7.5% for a paperback within the first year or two. So if they figure that what you're going to be earning back is $3,000 worth of royalties, that's how much they're gambling on.
Yeah.
And once the advance is earned out, then you will get further royalties. And if the advance never gets earned out, then they're only on the hook for that much, as much as they've paid you.
Yeah.
And the cost of printing the book, of course, which is the rest of theirs. But the thing is that if that's what they are willing to bet they are going to be able to sell of your books, it's 3,000 copies. Now, if the book is selling for $20 and you're getting 10%, that's $2. So that's 1,500 copies before they make the $3,000 that you would have in advance. If a publisher is offering you a $3,000 advance, they are saying, realistically, they think that perhaps this book will only sell 1,500 copies. And this is what most of them are guessing. Most books do not earn out.
Yeah.
It sort of tells you that it's very difficult to sell 1,500 copies of a book.
Yep.
And unless Oprah chooses you for her book club, or something of that sort, unless you get an awful lot of notoriety, you just are not going to sell those books.
Well, it's true. It's a sober reality, but it's absolutely true. Well, you know, Ellen, one of the things I've been curious about ever since learning about you is what does a lawyer specializing in copyright, media, publishing, and entertainment law do, and why might a writer hire you?
Well, I do a bunch of different things. Basically, one of the things that I do, I think, is perhaps burst people's balloons, but, you know, basically vet, that's a legal term, where you look into and evaluate offers and do due diligence and tell you whether the publisher is actually a legitimate publisher or not.
Okay.
And I get a lot of people who call me and say, oh, I've had an offer, they want to publish my book, and the first thing I say is, are they asking you for money? And when they say yes, I just say, forget it, it's bogus.
Yeah.
But after that, you know, sometimes there are times to evaluate this and say, yes, it may be a legitimate company, but I don't know if you will be happy with this, and you have to understand the reality. So that's part of it. The second part is, assuming that you do want to go with that publisher, I will negotiate the book contract. Now, if you have an agent, the agent can do that for you too. But if you don't have an agent, negotiating the book contract is not something that you should go into by yourself if you don't know your way around it. And all book contracts should be negotiable, at least in some part, so that I, you know, if you hire me, I can tell you what the book contract means, and either you can negotiate it and come back to me, or I can negotiate it and get words changed in it.
So let me just stop you for a minute, and then you can go on.
Okay.
One of the things that I've always heard is that most publishers just send you the bottom rung boilerplate contract that's totally in their favor and not yours.
Well, they're always going to be in their favor.
Yep.
But you can get things changed. You
okay.
can always get some things changed.
So that's why, that's one of the things we'd have a publishing lawyer do for
right.
us.
Right. Another one of the things would be to ascertain what rights you actually have in your book. Sometimes people collaborate with other people and they aren't quite sure who owns which rights. Or what rights are shared, and if they are shared, at what basis they are shared, and what happens if something happens to one of the partners in writing the book.
Yeah.
Let's say two people are writing the book, and one of them dies, and the person's husband, who was very hostile to the other person, is now the, you know, has inherited the copyright or something like that. Who has the right to negotiate this book further? And so this can be decided in agreements between the co-authors. If you are doing a biography of someone, if you want life rights, I have negotiated contracts where one writer, where the writer buys the rights, takes an option on the rights and does the biography, and then the writer, the subject can't sell the special stories as the authorized biography to any other person while that option clause is in effect. I also handle options and contracts when a movie company comes along and wants to turn the book into a movie, which we should all only be so lucky.
Yeah.
Because there is money that comes out of that. But, so there's a lot of that. If sometimes there will be rights that are held back, such as foreign rights, and those will be negotiated separately.
Okay.
So there's a lot of that. The other thing that I've been known to do, that I do, it's not just been known to do, that I do, actually, people don't realize that there's a copyright in photographs, just as there is a copyright in books. And the copyright in the photograph normally belongs to the person who took the photograph. So you have two sets of rights to clear on the photograph. One is the rights of the people who are in the photograph, who perhaps have privacy rights. And the other is the rights of the person who took the photograph, who owns the copyright in it. And if you want to print it in your book, you're going to have to get the rights. The other part is that I negotiate on occasion is where you want to use quotes from either poems or from other pieces of work. And it's not an academic type book, and the quotes are too lengthy. And sometimes we need to obtain permission to include those quotes in the way that we want to do that. And the other thing that I do very often is sometimes we'll vet a manuscript for libel and slander before it goes out for defamation.
Oh, yeah.
So somebody can bring their manuscript to me and say, is this chapter going to be troublesome? And we can look at it and say, well, it could be under these ways, in these circumstances, but not under those. Sometimes I can make a suggestion and the wording can be modified and we're probably better off. And sometimes I will just say, you know, you're going to have a problem with this, and if you really want to say this in the book, you're going to take the risk.
Okay. Wow. It sounds like you offer a wide range of help, and especially for people who are maybe going the publishing route without an agent and that extra kind of advocate for them.
And that's true. The problem is that it's not impossible to sell your book without an agent. It's more and more difficult.
Yeah.
But assuming that you can get somebody to look at the book, you really do need someone to look at the contract for you.
Yep. Well, I've sold all 9 of my books without an agent and never had a lawyer. And now talking to you, I wish I had. It would have been so much easier. Well, we have time for one last tip. So do you have any last tip for the listeners?
Well, I'm not 100% sure, you know, this, what we haven't covered, and there's so much. But I think the most important thing is that you have to assume now with the copyright, which copyrights are now good for the life of the author plus 70 years.
Oh.
So you have to really assume that anything that you are trying to quote from is probably protected by copyright unless you know it's really, really old, like Charles Dickens or the Bible,
yeah.
or even a new translation of the Bible could be protected. But let's say a work by Charles Dickens or Shakespeare, those are in the public domain. Pretty much everything else you should be assuming is covered by copyright. And if it is covered by copyright, you need to make sure that you can either get permission from the author or the work is in the public domain. And I think that's probably the most important thing is for protecting yourself from being sued by other people. If you want to protect your own rights, then the best thing to do is make sure that you understand what they are.
And we should also include translators in that, because in my recent book, I had to also pay a translator for using a quote from something he had translated.
And that's why I said sometimes even in new editions of the Bible, which would be a new translation, would be protected, because it's someone's new work. So a translation is a copyrightable work.
Ellen, that's fascinating. And I hope that our listeners will pick up a copy of your book, Every Writer's Guide to Copyright and Publishing Law, because I think a lot of this is in there and will help people a lot.
And my other book, which is a little bit older, but I think you can it's out of print, but you can get it on Amazon, which is called From Pen to Print, The Secrets of Getting Published Successfully.
Yes.
It does describe a lot of the publishing process, how to find a publisher, what your manuscript has to look like, what happens when you're going through through submitting the manuscript to a publisher who has already decided that they're going to publish it. It might be very helpful for people, too.
Well, thank you for reminding me about that. And thank you, Ellen. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
Great. This has been another edition of Always Write with Rochelle, the Write Now Coach. You can find a link to Ellen's books at my website, writenowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.